This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. After the attacks on September 11, 2001, families all across the United States grieved over the friends, the relatives, and the loved ones who died. Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez were one of those families grieving the loss of their son, Greg. And while they were overwhelmed by the pain, they quickly began to feel a sense of dread about the U.S. government and how it might react, and they feared even more violence would follow. So they put their feelings into action. Orlando penned an open letter asking for a nonviolent response. And they united with other families around the country to form 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. It's an organization of family members of the deceased seeking nonviolence and reconciliation. The new film, In Our Son's Name, tells their story, and it's screening around the state this weekend. I'm joined in the studio now by one of the film's central subjects, Phyllis Rodriguez. Welcome to the state. Thanks so much. So great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Start by telling us about your son, Greg.
Well, my son, Greg, was 31. He was working in IT for Cantor Fitzgerald, which was a Wall Street firm. It's a sign of status to be on the high floors. And it's also necessary in the corporate world to get to work early and show you're really serious and determined, you know. And so he was there. He was married, happily married, and he and our daughter-in-law were planning to get some financial security and then start raising a family, et cetera. He had been rebellious in his adolescence, teen, and young adult years, and then he had settled down. So he was in a really great place.
Walk us through how you found out about the events that day. You actually heard from Greg after the attack.
Well, if I had come home just like 5 minutes sooner from a walk I took that morning, as everyone remembers, in the Northeast, it was a beautiful sunny day, you know, and I was starting a new regimen of taking long walks. When I got home to our apartment building, the porter told me that the World Trade Center was on fire. So I ran up the stairs and I turned on the TV. The answering machine was flickering. There was a message. And it was from Greg. And, you know, in those days, it didn't calibrate or tell you what time the message came in. But I reconstructed it later. And it said, there's been a terrible accident at the Trade Center. I'm okay. Call Elizabeth. That's our daughter-in-law. And then I'm watching the TV, and I see that one plane had hit. And while I'm calling the family to tell in my crazy optimism that Greg is okay, I'm watching the second plane hit. As like everybody realized it was not an accident, but the main thing was to find Greg. My daughter asked me, where did he call from? And I said, who would stay in a burning building and make a phone call, you know? Right. He must be outside. We didn't learn. We were like thousands of others. We didn't know for sure that he had perished until about 36 hours later. But we did what all the families did, you know, doing searches. But we were very fortunate in a way, because Cantor lost the most of any one company, almost like 785 people. And the CEO organized IT people from Cantor and other companies to create a database. And overnight, they tracked just about everybody who worked for the company. And he announced the next evening that if we haven't found your family member, he or she is presumed dead. And that's when we had to really accept it.
So it came to you early, because it can be so difficult over those days and weeks of not knowing. That I can't imagine the anguish of not knowing. Just 3 or 4 days after the attacks, your husband penned an open letter. Tell us about that.
Well, from the first, he was at work in the Bronx. He teaches at Fordham University. And took him a while to get home, but he did get home that evening. And we were just talking. We couldn't not talk about it because we are politically conscious. We've always been. And we knew right away that if the hijackers were Muslim, there were going to be serious consequences from this. As a matter of fact, one of the first things I was hoping was that they not be. But once we knew that they most likely were, and then it seemed pretty sure, we're anti-war. We've been anti-war for a long time. And we realized that our beliefs were the same on September 10th. But on September 11th, we became victims' parents. Our overriding culture is a vengeful and violent one. And I've always been attracted to stories of people who someone was murdered or there was some tremendous atrocity who could be, who did not go with the flow. And who also reached out to the offender's family and the offender. So we knew that people would listen to us. And I think that's most likely the same thing that the other families who did similar things at that time, that, you know, people say, what? You know, they say, well, we're going to get him. Blah, blah, blah. So that led to Orlando's disappearing 3 days later into his study and knocking out this letter.
Will you read for us some of that letter?
Yes. It's titled Not in Our Son's Name. Our son Greg is among the many missing from the World Trade Center attack. Since we first heard the news, we have shared moments of grief, comfort, hope, despair, fond memories with his wife, the two families, our friends and neighbors, and his loving colleagues at Cantor Fitzgerald eSpeed, plus all the grieving families that meet daily at the Hotel Pierre. We see our hurt and anger reflected among everybody we meet. We cannot pay attention to the daily flow of news about this disaster, but we read enough of the news to sense that our government is heading in the direction of violent revenge, with the prospect of sons, daughters, parents, friends in distant lands dying, suffering, and nursing further grievances against us. It's not the way to go. It will not avenge our son's death, not in our son's name. Our son died a victim of an inhuman ideology. Our actions should not save the same purpose. Let us grieve, let us reflect and pray. Let us think about a rational response that brings real peace and justice to our world, but let us not, as a nation, add to the inhumanity of our times.
It's Phyllis Rodriguez reading from a letter in Not in Our Son's Name. It was written by her husband, Orlando. Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez helped form a group of families in response to the 9/11 Families for a Peaceful Tomorrows. You sent that letter around to other people. Tell us how the letter itself gained traction and recognition.
Yeah, well, it was not the way we thought it would. We asked a friend of ours to send it to the New York Times. But meanwhile, we sent it to our friends as a way who weren't close enough to know or we hadn't been to notify them of Greg's death in this way. And so we sent a mass email. And our friend, before sending it to the Times, our friend in San Francisco sent it to his friends. And then it just ballooned and it got to people, you know, anti-war, peace organizations, reconciliation groups, etc. And by the time the New York Times, 2 weeks later, the New York Times asked us if it had been published anywhere else. We said, "Oh, only on the internet."
So no.
Yeah. So that is how it happened.
Tell us then about other families then seeking you out, or maybe the formation and the origins of 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. How did that happen?
Well, from what I know, and I think I can be corrected or can be enhanced by David Petorti, a fairy godmother had collected all of us who had had letters, interviews on radio, television, talks at organizations, somehow found out our contact, our emails, and wrote to us each individually asking permission to share it with others. And to my knowledge, we all said yes. I think there were about 12 to 20 of us.
Well, that, and so eventually then that's how the group came together. But there's another interesting, very interesting element to this story in that you developed a friendship with the mother of one of the accused co-conspirators, Zacharias Moussaoui. Tell us about that.
Well, in November of 2001, he was indicted on 6 counts of conspiracy. He had been in detention by what was then called the INS, is now called ICE, for overstaying a visa. He had been there for a month. So I won't go into guilt or not, or whether he knew about the attacks or not, but he definitely had been working for Al-Qaeda. And his mother, his mother is a Moroccan woman who emigrated to France with her family, and he was born in France. So she had come over to meet with his defense lawyers, and the death penalty would be the ultimate punishment if he were found guilty. And so she had come over escorted by interpreters and supporters from a French human rights group that is dedicated to working against the death penalty in the U.S. And through those, their coming and through international abolition groups, the then director of Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation met and broached the subject of her meeting with some of the family members here. And I had said, and I know I'm not the only one, that I would really like to meet her someday because I felt great sympathy for her. You know, people would tell me, oh, your son, what a hero. He was a hero. I got unlimited sympathy until I maybe expressed my feelings that went counter to what was being broadcast. But people assumed that Aisha was a bad person and had caused her son to be attracted to Al-Qaeda. And I felt, you know what? We both did our best in raising our kids. You know, it's not an easy road. So it was actually about a year later, a group of us who were able from Peaceful Tomorrows went to a meeting with her and also with some other murder victims' families who had met with the family members of people who had killed there.
What was that meeting like for you?
It was fabulous because we were all nervous. We didn't know why she wanted to meet with us. Our purpose was to show human support for her and to tell her we don't have anything against her personally and that we just want to show that she's suffering too. She wanted the same thing, to tell us how she feels.
Well, joining us now is David Portorti. He's a literature and theater director at the North Carolina Arts Council and a member of 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, living in Cary. David, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
Tell us how you became involved in this group.
Well, my story is very similar to Phyllis's. My brother, Jim, worked for Marsh McLennan in the North Tower of the World Trade Center. The first plane went right into his office, so we did not get a phone call from Jim. And I found myself, you know, I'm just an ordinary guy, and I found myself thinking, you know, I never imagined that my brother would be a murder victim, you know, that he would be a victim of violence. And I also never imagined that I would be in a position where I would also call for violence. You know, it was like I received this gift that day, and some gifts are good and some gifts are bad, but this thing falls into your lap. And I realized that I did not want to respond to terrorism by becoming a terrorist myself.
Was that really your first response?
My first response was, how could this possibly have happened? You know, it was sort of anger at, you know, why didn't my country protect my brother? We're spending $1 billion a day on national defense. How did this happen? But I think it was never an angry response. It was always about, oh my gosh, we're going to unleash forces on this world that we will not have a way of calling back. And I remember there was a press conference the day after 9/11 probably within 24 hours, Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense at the time, and the reporters were saying, what does this mean? And he said, it means the era of the safe war is over. And I remember that quote, and I went, you know, what an odd thing to say, that when was a war ever safe? Mm-hmm. And I think what he really meant is that our perception has changed now to the point where we need to sort of, you know, think differently about this.
Well, people around the world have understood that civilians are held hostage to war. Mm-hmm. Certainly they know that in Japan and in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where 700,000 innocent civilians were killed, to make a point that we would use the bomb. That's
sure.
Now clear from the archive. It's not what Americans were told at the time, but we now see it in the documents. Interestingly enough, you have created a partnership with families from Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
Yeah, when we started this group, it was on Valentine's Day. I think that's when we met, Phyllis, was on Valentine's Day in 2002. We immediately started hearing from peace groups around the world. I think the first group we heard from was a group of Israelis and Palestinians called the Family Circle, a Families Forum, Parent Circle. And they were working to find peace between Palestinians and Israelis. We heard from the Hibakusha, who are very elderly survivors of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and they want their stories to be told and never forgotten. We heard from Guernica survivors and went to visit them. So all these groups, we just became aware that these groups were already there and that we were now part of their circle. It was not certainly a club we wanted to belong to, but that they were there. And many of our members, and I went to Japan as well and spoke about our group and had a wonderful reception from them, because I remember them saying, people in Japan are bored with peace. They're bored with peace, the young people. And we want them to hear your stories, because your stories are sort of bringing a fresh light to their feelings.
Well, Phyllis, the documentary that is showing now around the state is traces the story, this particular story, and this part of your life. What is it like for you to be working through your grief so publicly and in this way?
It's a mixed bag. I feel fortunate that I have the wherewithal to try to have some good come from something horrible. The film is, it's a personal story. It also has some humor. It's not stark. It engages people. This is what we're hearing. The filmmaker, Gayla Jamison, is not only a true artist, but very... She really wanted to tell the story. She didn't invest any other motive. And it does seem to speak to people. It does raise feelings. But I must say that I love speaking to the audiences who see it. And sometimes the audience is six people and sometimes it's 200. And I really love it, because not everybody agrees with what we're preaching, so to speak. But to just open up to people that it's possible to think otherwise, and that it's possible to act on it, and open dialogue. So yes, I pay an emotional toll, we both do, but it's worth it. We never imagined it would come to this or be so appreciated, but we're very pleased. And it is going to be on PBS in September. The filmmaker she's not here for this tour because she's working with her technical people to get it to the specifications for PBS.
It's Phyllis Rodriguez, who is one of the primary subjects of the new documentary, In Our Son's Name. Phyllis, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
David Pertorti is also with us. He's a literature and theater director for the North Carolina Arts Council and a member of 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. David, thank you.
Thank you.
In Our Son's Name is going to be screening at Cameo Art House Theater in Fayetteville and Duke Divinity School in Durham on Saturday. It's going to be in Raleigh on Sunday and then Warren Wilson College on Wednesday. And we've got all of that information about the screenings in North Carolina at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we preview a new documentary about life in rural Bertie County in eastern North Carolina. Stay tuned.